Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called.
And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide
at 1041kqth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, Tucson. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Fascinating, fascinating interview. We're going to talk about World War II. Now, most of you are probably familiar with the Battle of the Bulge during the Second World War, but the majority of you may not have heard so much about the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest. Hürtgen Forest was the longest battle of World War II fought on German soil. From the 19th of September 1944 until the 10th of February 1945, U.S. and German forces fought for yards of territory in a densely wooded area about 50 square miles wide. Now, the Germans held well-fortified defensive positions, and they employed some fearsome and accurate artillery barges. Due to the denseness of the forest, Allied assets had to be mostly limited to infantry. It was in the Hürtgen that the U.S. First Army encountered exploding trees, a German tactic whereby artillery bursts were set to detonate 80 to 100 feet off the ground, shattering the treetops and sending a rain of shrapnel and splinters down upon the U.S. troops. Many units suffered a 100% casualty rate from the fighting. By the end of the battle, the U.S. had suffered 33,000 casualties and the Germans 28,000. Unfortunately, historians consider the victory, the eventual American victory, of very little strategic value. Today on American Warrior, we're joined by a man who has quite a bit of personal experience with the horrors of the Hürtgen Forest, along with Normandy, St. Lo, and the Battle of the Bulge itself. He was born to a Russian Jewish family living in Berlin. When Hitler came to power, his family left for Paris, where Victor completed his early studies. Then, as the German army advanced on Paris in 1940, Victor and his family had to relocate again, eventually escaping to the United States via Spain. He is one of a select group of immigrants comprising a special unit recruited and trained for frontline intelligence and interrogation during the Second World War. Their story was featured in the documentary film The Ritchie Boys. Our discussion today will principally be based upon his experiences as outlined in a great book that I recommend you read called Trains of Thought, Memories of a Stateless Youth. He's a great writer. I encourage you to pick up his book. Victor, let me try this.
Yes, I'm here.
Bienvenue à la radio de guerrière américaine.
Pardon?
How was that? I blew it. I was trying to say welcome to American Warrior in French.
Yes, bienvenue.
Well, let's just stick to German and Spanish. That's my strength. Let's do the whole show in German, Victor.
Well, you know, I just recently had went on a visit to Berlin. I gave a lecture there at the Literaturhaus in Berlin about the war, which they are celebrating their defeat as a form of liberation.
Well, now that's very interesting. What? Tell me more about that. You were invited. How many was it at a university or just?
No, it is a literary association. They have that kind of institution or institute in many cities. It's called the Literaturhaus. I was invited by journalists, and it was a very warm and, for me, rather moving occasion where I spoke about Berlin, destroyed Berlin, as I saw it when we arrived with the American army. And I talked also about the Hürtgen Forest battle, because that was a battle on German soil, not far from Aachen. And there were many questions, and I was interviewed, and there was also a newspaper article about my book and about me. So it was a kind of ego trip also, but it was very moving.
Well, and you know, Victor, I'm so glad you started with that, because that's part of the main reason we are on the air with American Warriors. I believe that these perspectives re-examined through the lenses of the present time, back looking on the past, hopefully will teach us not to make some of those mistakes again. Although, I don't know if we'll ever be without war.
No, but mistakes will be made.
No question. Now, what else are you up to now? Are you working on another book? Any other travel besides Berlin?
Well, I just come back from a lecture in Cleveland, where I talk about a recent book, but it does not have anything to do with the war. And I'm writing now a sequel to Trains of Thought.
Wonderful. Now, before we get into the main topic, yeah. We had you on the show before talking about, when we did a feature show on the Ritchie Boys. Just to bring folks up to speed, that was a special unit, principally immigrants, a lot of Jewish young men. I think you had American Indians in the group as well, as a matter of fact.
Yes, we had Brits and we had Poles and Czechs and Italians. It was a mixed bag, but many of them came from Central Europe, from Germany and from Austria, and many of them were indeed Jewish, yes.
And the idea behind the Ritchie Boys was to take native speakers who had a familiarity with Europe, particularly Germany and France, and train you as intelligence officers or intelligence personnel and interrogators, and then send you back into the grinder, I guess, if you will, to provide that key part of our victory in Europe.
Right. Every division that landed had a team of six Ritchie camp trained personnel who were military combat intelligence people doing a reconnaissance behind the lines, but also and above all interrogation of frontline prisoners, civilians, in my case also in France, liaison with the French resistance movement, so it was a variety of activities and even frontline broadcasts to the troops, to the German troops, trying to have them surrender.
I tell you, Victor, I'm going to get a little bit more into that because I think that segment of your book was almost like a scene out of Catch-22. I mean, literally, folks, read his book because Victor not only was there, not only experienced it, but he has got a particular flair or style of writing that I think is important to read. And I just the way you describe some of these terrible, terrible things, Victor, in an almost poetic way, I find very, I mean, congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the... You're a good impresario.
Well, except
for you as an agent.
Except for my French, perhaps. So, Victor, we're about coming up on a commercial break here in a couple of minutes, but let's just sort of introduce the next section with, folks can go to our podcast to hear about the Ritchie Boys part of your life, but let's put you in England just prior to the invasion of Normandy. What was this? So before, I mean, you kind of had a sense that something was happening, but sort of what was the feel there in England at the time? I think you were quartered with a family, correct?
Yes, I was billeted with a family while we were on maneuvers in the Salisbury Plain. I was attached at that point to the 2nd Armored Division, which was nicknamed, it has a nickname, Hell on Wheels. It was the old division that General Patton commanded. It had acquired quite a bit of reputation for efficiency, courage in Sicily, landings in Sicily. But then it was the 1st Armored Division to land on Omaha Beach. So that's where we landed. But in the meantime, I was with this British family. And, you know, England was at that point going through a very noble, courageous period. That family was extremely well, friendly, warm toward me, and treated me with great kindness, lending me the bike to explore the landscape. But those were just the side aspects of what was it. In fact, our main business, which was training for the invasion in the Salisbury Plain, and having pre-invasion simulated landings.
And Victor, when we come back from the commercial break, we're going to have to break now, but I want you to tell that. There was a little story you tell in your book about an incident that speaks specifically to that situation where you were invited to lecture a group of officers about what they might experience, and it turns out you're a little more accurate than you had planned to be. Folks, it's your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, joined by Victor Brombert, one of the Ritchie Boys World War II veteran. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back. We're here on American Warrior with our guest, Victor Brombert. Victor is a veteran of World War II, was member of a special intelligence and interrogation unit called the Ritchie Boys. Victor, before we took the break, we were talking a little bit about your time in England. And in your book, it made me smile. I guess sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, but you were assigned to lecture a group of officers about just kind of what they might encounter in a typical French town when they arrived. And you took sort of a storybook town. You had the butcher, the baker, the mayor.
All invented.
All invented, right.
It was the very first lecture I ever gave. Many, many years later, I trained to become a professor of literature, which I did become. But this was my very first lecture. I was considered French. All my schooling in Paris, my childhood, my adolescence. And so I was to talk to the officers of the 2nd Armored Division about what they might find in a typical French town. And so I just picked a map. And, well, during my childhood, I had gone to certain resorts on the Norman coast, coast of Normandy, Cabourg, Deauville, Trouville, I knew very well. I didn't want to point in that direction, so I picked arbitrarily a region of Normandy I didn't know at all. And it so happens, by pure chance, I picked the region where we did land, Omaha Beach and Utah Beach, that is somewhere between Caen, Bayeux, and Carentan. And no one afterwards, we landed precisely in that region, no one believed that I was not secretly briefed ahead of time and that I knew exactly where we were going to land, which was not the case at all. And in order to describe this this town, this imaginary town where we would be, I drew on memories of films I had seen as a boy, of books I had read as an adolescent about a typical French town, and out of Maupassant and other writers, stereotypes, the priest, the baker, the baker's wife, the church, the school building, all that. And it was most encouraging to me, and my colleagues admired me much for having kept secret the until then my knowledge. But this was all invented.
What they didn't know doesn't hurt them. Now, how long prior before the invasion was this?
Oh,
a matter of weeks, or
2 weeks? 2 weeks,
okay.
Maybe. Yeah, not more than that.
I'm surprised you didn't get a visit from an MP saying, "Okay, Victor, we need to have a chat."
That's right. Well, it didn't get beyond the division, but that's exactly where we landed. No. But it was a great encouragement. I really enjoyed giving that lecture, and I think that retrospectively, it was my first experience, my first almost initiation to the craft of lecturing, which I exercised both at Yale and at Princeton, as you know.
Yes, sir. Now, you, your group, you landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day plus two. But again, in your book, I also find it interesting you described as you're headed to the port to depart for Normandy. I'll actually steal your words. You said it all looked incongruously festive. There were Red Cross nurses giving you guys donuts. There was, ships and boats and planes and what? I mean, just kind of describe the sort of the energy you felt as you headed towards.
Well, this was the port of, we were all driving in long, long convoys towards Southampton. And I knew Southampton because I had been in a summer college in England in 1938, which is 2 years. It was 2 years before the war in Europe began. But the port looked very, very different now. It was filled with a flotilla of boats and landing crafts. And yes, indeed, it looked festive, not only because of the donuts. Well, we needed the donuts and the coffee because we were proceeding very slowly on the roads and getting thirsty and hungry. But then when we got to the port, there was a barrage of balloons attached to the boats by solid wires, I think it was. Yes, it was, of course, in order to protect the boats against low-level air attacks. It looked indeed quite festive, but of course we were apprehensive. And I remember that we were given seasickness pills before mm-hmm. we got onto the landing crafts, which was a good thing because we probably were a bit numbed. But we had a sense of panic, sure. It was not a comfortable feeling moving on the seas that were rather turbulent. On the landing day, the weather was very bad. But even when we landed, it was grim.
Now, Victor, what did you encounter? I found it interesting, again, when you described just your ability to write and your descriptive style, describing Omaha Beach when you arrived. And prior to that, when folks read the book, you'll see when you were drafted, you had a certain... I think you called it a virus for heroism, but when you got there, and particularly your first few days on Omaha Beach and heading inland, and you, from that, in fact, I'll quote, you said, from that point on, I kept telling myself, let's win the war, but without loving it. You had been cured of the virus of heroism, if you will.
Yes, but it wasn't immediate. Of course, when we landed, it was a rather grim sight. There were still the anti-tank ditches, the pillboxes, debris, wounded people, half-sunk landing crafts. During the night, I spent on a bluff. We were strafed by German planes, but I still thought that I might become heroic, or that I would be a hero. I was to some extent sobered by later experiences, especially the Battle of the Bulge and the Hürtgen Forest. That those were very difficult moments. But yes, I think I use that expression. Let's win the war, but without loving it, because there was the smell of death all over the Norman fields, the dead cows, the carcasses of animals, amusing contradiction of terms in my mind, so dead livestock. I remember I thought about that, and of course the view of the fallen soldiers, that the corpses, that was particularly grim. I think I do describe some of that, the not only the cows and the other animals, and the smell, the sweetish, unbelievable sweet smell of death. But the bodies of the soldiers, I remember one image that has remained haunting me. It was the image of two American soldiers who were lying there almost like a couple in love, a love couple. And one of them was a medic. The medics, by the way, were great heroes in the war. One of them was a medic who had fallen over the body of the person he was, the soldier he was trying to save. And their hands were almost clutching each other. They were close together, as though ready for a loving clasp. That image has remained. But there were many worse images. If I may, for a moment, because I think I know the passage that you referred to.
Okay, we've got about a minute left before the break. So.
All right, I just want to read the one image that was sort of also the most horrific, where the corpses close to tanks or on top of them, tank drivers, their bodies folded over the turret, or gunners and mechanics who had crawled out of the escape hatches but didn't make it. They had tried to get out of their tank when it was hit and set aflame. Half burned, they had been finished off by shells or machine gun fire. They were often burned beyond recognition, barely human forms. And even the demolished tanks looked like mutilated animals, their underbellies gutted, leaning on their side like extinct prehistoric beasts. No, I've been reading a little passage there, but these images have remained with me, and that's why I was able to write about them many, many years later.
Victor, thank you so much. Folks, stick around. What a great interview. We'll be right back with more from Victor Bromberg and the Battle of Herzen Forest.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior. We're joined by Victor Brombert. Victor is a World War II veteran, but because of the nature of his work, he was a member of a special unit that was nicknamed the Ritchie Boys. They were specifically trained to do intelligence and interrogation work. Victor, welcome back to American Warrior. Now, if I read this correctly in your book, it seems like, to some extent, you were shuttled around between different units throughout the course of the war, just as your expertise was needed, correct?
Well, at first, during the landings, I was attached together with my team. We were six. We were attached to the 2nd Armored Division, but later, after the French campaign, because we were specializing in French liaison and reconnaissance, interrogation, but of civilians, liaison with the French. But then I was, during the German campaign, I was attached to the 28th Infantry Division. And that was the time of the Battle of the Bulge and especially the Hürtgen Forest.
Now, you, moving into that period, you referenced it before the break, and I love this passage in your book because it kind of reminds me of how sometimes war can be almost farcical. And you're talking about a project by Colonel Perkins. And if I may just read from your book, you said, only two members of our French team spoke fluent German, Sergeant Andrew and myself. It thus fell principally to us to get down to regiment headquarters, from there to battalion and company headquarters, and from there on foot, moving forward cautiously and bent over near the outpost to a point beyond which we had to crawl along a sunken road past helmets lying on the ground with ominous holes in them. Three times a day on two successive days we went on this expedition to deliver our message to the Germans cajolingly. Three times a day we crawled along the sunken road past the pierced helmets. Always the same response from the other side, mortar shells whistling down on us. Not a single German surrendered. And what was the colonel's mad project?
Well, the colonel, you know, had a very limited interest in military intelligence. This colonel was the G2 of the 2nd Armored Division. He was an ex-cavalry officer who had, no training in military intelligence, I believe. So he had some strange ideas about making use of us. And one of them was to use us as a propaganda machine, sending the two people who knew German, crawling, as you described it, to the outposts were all the way down close to the German lines to address the German troops and ask them, cajolingly, as you say, to surrender. In fact, in the meantime, the Signal Corps GI was killed, putting up the loudspeakers in the tree. We were interrupted by mortar fire and had to withdraw. It was a foolish, foolhardy decision on his part, but he himself It is rumored, this I don't know personally, but it is he used to drink apparently and look at night in his tent. He said, "Where is the lost platoon? I must go look for the lost platoon." And on successive nights went out driving with his Austrian refugee, also driver, and on the third night they didn't come back. They were looking with a flashlight for a lost platoon, can you imagine? Yes, you say farcical. It's more than farcical.
It was tragic.
It's tragic comic, yes. That's what it is. But he also was responsible, the same colonel, for my being attached personally alone to a reconnaissance unit working behind the lines. He thought that would be a smart move. So I was in a half-track together with reconnaissance people, reconnaissance half-track, you know, it's an armored vehicle propelled by caterpillar threads in the rear and a pair of wheels in front. And this is how I got a glimpse, not just a glimpse, but a full spectacle of the carpet bombing at Saint-Lô, the famous breakthrough at Saint-Lô. But I had no business being there in this reconnaissance half-track, because that wasn't my function, but that was his idea. So, you know, sometimes you get strange orders. Some of the orders of our generals in the Hürtgen Forest, if we get to that a little later, were determined to do things that were now considered completely outlandish, that they were fighting troops there while the Germans were preparing. The Germans were trapping us there because they were preparing the Rundstedt offensive, the Battle of the Bulge, and they tried to get us into this forest in inch by inch fighting, tiring, destroying, decimating our troops that way. So, you know, it's not always that generals and leaders are doing the bright thing. I'm sorry if I say things that are slightly heretical, but it's true.
Yeah, one of the things, Victor, I found interesting in the movies that those of us in younger generations watch, there's references to these special German troops that were put into U.S. Army uniforms sent behind the lines disguised to try and create, to sow confusion. Now, this created a very interesting encounter for you and your team at a checkpoint. Folks probably haven't noticed, but your accent is not exactly like you'd hear from Texas. So tell our folks about your team's encounter with a checkpoint.
My accent is nothing compared to some of the other accents in my team. They were mostly in that second team, the 28th Infantry Division. There was a Hungarian with a very thick Hungarian accent. There was a German with a pretty, very German accent, and others. What happened, our own troops got very nervous, trigger happy, because the Germans had infiltrated. This is during the Battle of the Bulge. They had infiltrated in American uniforms. They had infiltrated our troops and were creating havoc. They were particularly careful at checkpoints, and so not only was there a password, but they would ask us, I remember this was a comic incident, but it could have ended badly.
Mm-hmm.
We were asked, well, okay, you got the password, but what's the Windy City? And most of us had been, you know, had recently arrived in the United States, and we didn't know what the Windy City is. Every American, I think, immediately thinks of Chicago, but not one of us knew that. So I had to talk very fast. They gave us a second chance, and they said, okay, who won the World Series? We didn't even know the rules of baseball. You know, I say trigger happy. There is, for instance, the incident of one of our men in one of our Ritchie boys who was going to a latrine late at night and asked a password and answered in it with a German accent, and he was shot, killed
Our
own troops.
Wow.
Yes. So we were in danger. However, the incident is comical, of course, And I like to remember it as one of the sort of, you know, picturesque or memorable moments. But the really memorable moments of the Battle of the Bulge and the Hütgen Forest are the incidents, the fight, the snow, the mud in the Hütgen Forest, the snow, the blinding snow in the Battle of the Bulge.
Now, you described in the book, Victor, that, I mean, obviously Normandy was bloody, the Battle of the Bulge was bloody, but the Battle of Hütgen Forest you described as erosive.
Well, that was really, I would say, my worst assignment. It was a real slaughter in that forest. Entire divisions were destroyed. But our generals were determined to have the infantry fight inch by inch through the dense, dark forest. And the Russian, the German troops were very well trained in, especially the ones that were there, because they had been in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had great experience in the snow and in forests. We had no experience. We didn't even have good clothes. So it was a grim affair, and the Hürtgenwald was eventually nicknamed the Death Factory.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think that's when our 28th Infantry Division got its nickname, the Bloody Bucket, with a reference to because the Infantry Division, 28th Infantry Division, had the emblem of the Red Pennsylvania emblem on the shoulder patch, and so all this is associated with the horrors of the Hürtgen Forest. We were paying for our exaggerated optimism or euphoria after the French campaign, because the Germans were in France on the run. After the Saint-Lô breakthrough, they were on the run. We thought the war is over. And then we had a rude awakening, precisely at the Hürtgen Forest and at the Siegfried Line. This is where the going through the forest became a real obsession for, especially the general of my division. His name is General Kota.
Mm-hmm.
But it was terrible because the Germans were very well defended. Our units broke. Men were running, you know, entire regiments were torn to pieces.
You know, we got to take another break here, Victor. When I come back, I want to read a passage from your book that specifically references General Kota and some of the orders he gave to you that I think that really exemplifies just how terrible things were there. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined live on the phone by Victor Brombert. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior. I'm joined live on the telephone by Victor Brombert. Victor is a World War II veteran. He's written just a wonderful book called Trains of Thought, Memories of a Stateless Youth. And we've been kind of pulling some segments out of that book talking about Victor's experience in the invasion of Fortress Europe. Victor, before we took a break, we were talking a little bit about the Hürtgen Forest and the Battle of the Bulge. And in particular, General Norman Dutch, I think, was his nickname, Kota. In your book, you talk about where you, well, let me just read the passage out of the book here, and you can expound on it for our listeners. A few hours later, at early dawn on the edge of a sloping field, we came upon grim-looking General Kota himself. He was there, pistol in hand in the early morning fog and snow, ordering the remnants of his division to make a stand. That moment later haunted me when the German tank swiveled its obscene muzzle and hit our ammunition truck, lighting up the macabre silhouettes of the trees. General Kota had singled me out, together with a few others, to organize the defense. The huge explosion put an end to our stand. Everybody was on the run again. Now, he had told you to dig in, let the tanks pass, and then take care of the following infantry, but the ground was frozen.
Yes. Not only that, but I think, if I remember correctly, he said, after having said, "I'll shoot any bastard who runs," he said, dig in, and he looked at me in particular. I was a master sergeant, and he put me in charge of digging in. Take your men. I had no men. So take your men and dig in. So both were absurdities, because it was, the ground was frozen, and I had no men. So all we had were, I had a carbine. That's what I had at that point. Mm-hmm. And no one else was very well armed. And what he said then, dig in and let the tanks pass and take care of the following infantry. And a few seconds later, tanks appeared. Indeed, even one tank was enough. I forgot now whether it was a Panther or a Tiger tank. I think it was a Panther. But it took one aim at our ammunition truck, which exploded, and fragments of all over, and I was dazed. And when I came to myself, I was alone. Everyone had run away. There was not even the general also was gone. So that's how. Then I escaped. I ran to my jeep. I had a jeep, and two other soldiers jumped onto it, and we drove off. But it was utter confusion at that point. People no longer know where their unit was. There was no more unit. There was no more headquarters. It looked like a lunar landscape. All of it was frozen. It was a ghastly, nightmarish, almost, yes, but in a sense, poetic sight. It was like a scene out of Dante.
Mm-hmm. Now, later on, correct me if I'm wrong, sir, but General Cota was involved in another very tragic incident. The very first U.S. soldier shot for desertion since the Civil War. Was that one of your comrades that he had ordered executed allegedly for deserting? Or?
It wasn't a comrade. It was someone, a poor fellow, some kind of... excuse me, there is... it was, I think his name was Eddie Slovic. It's a famous case. It's the only American so-called deserter to be executed. He was really feeble-minded, and he lost his nerve. He was battle-shocked, during the Battle of the Bulge, and executed many months later, a couple of months later, in Alsace. We were at that point, 28th Infantry Division, which had regrouped its forces, it had, in other words, been reconstructed, was helping the French in liberating the only important French city that had not yet been liberated, which was Colmar, mm-hmm. in Alsace. It's in a little village called Sainte-Marie-aux-Mines, where we were, our division headquarters. That's where this chap was executed. Yes, I think it was the first time someone was executed for desertion, first time an American was executed since the Civil War.
Now, we've got, Victor, just only about time flies when I've got a great guest, but I want to jump forward a little bit because there's something that really struck me in your book because it reminded me so much of current affairs. And you were talking about after Nazi Germany was defeated, you were assigned to a task force in charge of denazification. And you expressed some frustration in that very often the person, and this was not easy going. I mean, the Germans obviously were not real fans of talking to someone about, ratting someone else out. But you were frustrated because you said very often the persons you arrested were released within 48 hours and then put in charge of various city and town administrations.
Well, yes, it's an interesting episode, which also is interesting because one could make then a contrast with what we did or didn't do in Iraq.
Exactly.
We had, my team and I, after hostilities, as our function in the Saar land, Saargebiet, near Saarbrücken, to denazify, in other words, to arrest not every Nazi party member, everybody was a member more or less, so that didn't matter. That had no consequence. No, leaders, that is, of course, Gauleiter, Kreisleiter, but all sorts of real ideologues and officials, really important, committed Nazis. It was very hard to make the Germans denounce them. Unlike the French, who, when we landed, suffered from an epidemic of denunciations. Everybody else was a collaborator. Everybody himself was a resistant fighter. In Germany, I don't know whether it was a sense of obedience or the fear that maybe the Nazis would come back or just simply a sense of dignity. I don't know what it was, but it was very difficult. We nonetheless arrested a number, and to my surprise, shock, anger, within 24 or 48 hours, the American, what were they called, military government, yes, because military government was not the intelligence service. We arrested and they liberated them because they said, well, we can't get run the city without them. They are the ones who know how to make people obey.
And you took to calling them the Knights of the Waste Paper Basket.
Well, yes, they were bureaucrats, and they were interested just in having things function, having the garbage collected, etc. Retrospectively, I think we made the opposite mistake, and this was a mistake of sorts, because some of these guys were later escaped to Argentina or elsewhere, you know, and so on.
Yeah.
However, in Iraq, we dismantled everything, including the army, to the point where we made it impossible to govern the country.
Well, and that's specifically why I brought it up, sir. I appreciate your perspective on that, because it did strike me, the parallels or the contrast to what's happened in Iraq. Victor, thank you so much for coming on American Warrior.
Thank you.
I tell you what, sir, you're a hero in my book.
Oh, hero. May I say a word about hero?
Okay.
No one is a hero. People sometimes do heroic things, but no one is born a hero or guaranteed to be a hero.
The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of KQTH or the EW Scripps Company.